You've reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave your message after the tone.
Hi, this is Paige, and I have a factual emergency. I was walking with my friend this morning, and she said, did you know that you can only breathe through one nostril at a time? And I just thought that sounded really wacky, and it can't be true, right?
Hello?
Hey, Paige, it's Flora from ELT.
Hi, Flora.
Let's talk about the source of this information. What's your friend's name?
Lisa.
Lisa. Okay, so tell me the story.
Well, Lisa and I are gym buddies, well, pre-COVID, and we were walking back from the gym one morning, I think about this time last year, and she said, hey, I heard this thing. You can only breathe through one nostril at a time. Did you know that? And I was like, what?
How often do you think about this alleged fact?
I don't know. I mean, I've been thinking about this on and off for the past year.
For the past year? Really?
Yeah. You know, when I'm breathing hard, I'm going on a run and I'm thinking about it, or I'm going to bed and you know how you lay on one side and it kind of seems like one nostril's hard to breathe through. I'm thinking about it then.
Do you think your friend Lisa's right?
I kind of think she's wrong. I just think there's no way that that's true.
Let's just do an experiment now. Let's try just breathing through the right nostril.
Okay, you want me to plug up the left?
No, I just, with your mind.
Oh, with my mind.
Mm-hmm. So just concentrate really hard.
I can't do it.
But are you really trying?
Maybe not. All right, what if I try the left?
Yeah, let's try the left.
I don't know. I can't tell. Do you have a dominant nostril?
You know, I don't think so.
So that's such a strange question.
I think it could be a good opener, you know, like a good Tinder thing or...
Oh, yeah.
Right side looking for a left side.
Oh, that'd be so cute.
What do you want to know?
Well, I want to know, do we breathe through one nostril at a time? And if so, I mean, yeah, what is the function? Why would that be?
Okay. We found someone who knows noses.
My name is Simon Gain, and I am a consultant rhinologist and ENT surgeon in London.
What's your relationship to nostrils?
I spend most of my working day inside them.
He's in the nose. If anyone can set the record straight on nostril gate, it's Simon. So I put your question to him. Do you only breathe through one nostril at a time? And are you ready for the answer, Paige?
I'm so ready. I've been waiting on this for a year.
Yes, most people breathe through one nostril at a time.
Most people breathe through one nostril at a time.
At a time, yeah, most people. Some estimates about 80% if you look.
I'm speechless.
Your friend Lisa was not snorting something. She's right. At any given moment, we're breathing mainly out of one side of our nose.
That's so weird. Is it always the same nostril or does it switch?
Every couple hours, the dominant side switches. So you could be a lefty in the morning and a righty by lunch. And the side switching happens subconsciously. Nerves send a signal to block up one nostril and unplug the other.
That's so weird. Why?
Yes. Why would our noses do this? Simon says there are a couple of theories. One has to do with smelling. So your dominant nostril is bringing in air quickly. But your resting nostril isn't off the clock completely. It's slowly snuffing up a little bit of air.
Huh.
And Simon says this difference in sniff speed may help you catch different whiffs.
There are olfactory receptors in the nose that take a little bit longer to pick up the odorants that are coming in. And so you're basically smelling different things at different air speeds, and therefore you want to max them out.
You want to have like one nostril bringing air in quickly to smell certain things and then one slowly to smell different things.
Exactly.
That's so weird.
That's one theory. But there's another theory about why your nostrils take turns breathing. But before we get into it, you need to know that when rhinologists talk about noses, they're not just talking about that cute little booger box above your milk mustache.
The thing that's stuck on the front of your face is the sort of the tip of the iceberg. Your nose goes all the way back to between your ears.
You've got a lot of nose plumbing behind your face. Picture two pipes snaking up from each nostril, feeding into two parallel HVAC systems.
Sometimes I'll say the left or the right nose.
Do people get confused by that?
Well, I'm only really talking to other rhinologists, so they know what I'm talking about. No one else cares about noses.
Yeah, you can't have this conversation with anyone else. Which brings us to the second theory of why we sniff or switch. It has to do with why we have a snort box in the first place.
So the air that we have outside is dirty, it's dry generally.
And it's usually too cold or too hot, and lungs like their air just right, around 97 or 98 degrees.
So your nose is really there to turn dirty, dry, cold air from outside into warm, humidified, cleaned air on the inside. And that's what your nose is doing all the time. That's why it's built the way it is.
The pipes in your nasal HVAC unit are coated with mucus and tiny grabby filaments called cilia. So the mucus humidifies the air and traps dirt, and the cilia move that dirty mucus along.
These little cilia sweep it to the back of your nose so you can swallow it down into your stomach, which is then bathed in a vat of hydrochloric acid that your stomach has been busy making all this time and neutralize any of the gunk.
I'm actually drinking the disgusting things I'm breathing in.
2 to 3 liters of gunk a day from the back of our nose and mouth. Saliva and mucus.
Ah,
it's a big nose job.
That is so gross. 2 to 3 liters?
I know. How much is that? I need to convert that to like a metric I know.
Well, a wine bottle is 750 milliliters, so 0.75 liters. So that's like 3 wine bottles.
Oh, God.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. A day.
A day, yeah.
And all that mucus making, cilia waving, dirt clearing, HVACing, that's a lot of work for a little nostril, which is why your body might want to use one side of the nose and give the other side a rest.
That other nostril might be just taking it easy, cleaning itself off, much in the same way as, you know, dolphins only sleep with half their brains. Maybe you want something that's active all the time, but actually you still want to give it a bit of a break. Because it's being bombarded by this cold, dry, dirty air. That is damaging. I mean, the lining of your nose at the front still gets damaged by it. So you might want to just allow some regeneration and some healing to take place. You know, give it a break while it sort of catches its breath, as it were.
Huh.
But there is a way to override the system. You can select which nostril to open up.
How? By thinking really hard?
Not exactly.
So there's an old yoga practice using a crutch into your armpit or your fist into the armpit to block the nose on the same side as that crutch. And that was investigated years ago now and demonstrated that pressure in the armpit will block the nose on that side.
Why would that be?
Maybe when you're an ape evolving on the savannah and you lie down for a snooze, you don't want the nostril that's closest to the ground to be hoovering up the bugs and the dirt. Maybe.
They must have had very strong nostrils back then.
That explains why it seems like when you lay down, you can only breathe through one nostril. And I'm also thinking how funny it is that the stinkiest part of your body controls which side of your nose that works.
So Lisa was right.
Yeah. Now I kind of want to know if I'm in the 20% or the 80%.
The 80% who alternate sides or the 20% who don't?
Yeah. I have answers, but I also have questions.
How will it change your life if you're in the 20 or the 80?
Well, I'm probably in the 80, but if I was in the 20, I'd feel like super strong, you know?
Why?
I could breathe through both. Max capacity.
After the break, Australian journalist and Gimlet host Wendy Zuckerman is on the show for a very important update.
That, I mean, that is unmistakable. That is a butthole.
G'day, Wendy Zuckerman, host of Science Versus.
How dare you? I hope y'all are doing real well.
I wanted to talk because I have some breaking news for you.
Ah.
On a topic I know you're passionate about.
Ooh, wombats?
Wombats.
Wombats.
The best butt down under.
Do you know my background on my computer is a wombat?
Is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know. I mean, I knew you were into their butts. I didn't know you were into the whole animal.
I just think they're great and kind of misunderstood. Like, we think they're cute, but actually, as you told me last time we were speaking, They're like very aggressive and they have these strong butts that they use in all these creative ways.
Yes.
You know, and yet our feeble minds are just like, no, it looks like a baby with fur.
So there's brand new research on womb butts.
What do we know now?
Okay, we're going to get there in a sec. But first, let's review.
Okay.
For our sizable non-Australian audience, wombats are not bats. They're marsupials. You find them in Australia's bush. And this is what they look like.
They're kind of like a obese toddler with basically really short arms and legs and the face of a teddy bear and the nose of a koala.
You see what I mean? This toddler, you know... But yes, that's a very, very accurate description.
That's David Hu. He's got a lab at Georgia Tech, and he led the research team that pushed out this new nugget.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Wendy.
G'day.
So David was looking into wombat poop, and it is unusual. First of all, these are some firm nugs.
Human poop is 80% water. A wombat poop is 60% water. It's quite dry.
Because of what they're eating?
Yeah, they live in dry environments, and they need to extract every last drop of liquid from their food.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I've seen wombat poo. It does look very dry. Like, if I did that poo, it makes me think that would have been a painful crap.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like bricks.
Not only that, they make a shit ton of them.
Yeah, they make about 100 poops a day. And if you look at their latrines, the place they poop, it looked like someone just broke a poop pinata.
Do you do anything 100 times a day?
If I were pooping 100 times a day, would I be able to have a full-time job?
It'd be difficult. Probably in the middle of this chat, at least one of us would have to do a poo. And would literally do one. Like right now, maybe.
You let me know. But the most perplexing thing about wombat poop is that it's cube-shaped.
If you ever eat Godiva chocolates, the kind with like that comes in a box with each little hole for a particular chocolate, it looks almost exactly like that in size and shape, except not the heart-shaped ones or the star ones or the seahorse ones.
Such a bad analogy.
It put a visual in my mind.
Yes, I have one too.
David says wombats are the only animals to shit bricks. And that's the mystery.
The poo was cubed and we didn't know why. Was that the great unknown?
Yes.
We were trying to understand how wombats can make it cubic. And the more you think about it, the stranger it gets. I mean, because their poops are hard and its intestines are soft. Soft things usually don't mold hard things, and definitely not into corners and edges. So the more we thought about it, the more weird we thought it was.
It's very weird. I'm also wondering, does he, like, when he's writing grants, because you know you have to justify your research, and often with stuff like this, scientists will say, because who knows, maybe we'll be able to make a butt-shaped robot squeeze out...
Godiva chocolates.
Some Godiva chocolates, and then who knows? Maybe we'll solve climate change. Do you know what his justification for wanting to know this marvelous mystery?
Yeah, as you can imagine, I've approached several program officers asking if they're interested in funding this project on wombat poop, and pretty much I got the door slammed in my face many, many times. Pretty much slammed in my face. So it was a huge labor of love, this paper.
I guess they don't get it. They don't get it.
So let's get to what David found.
All right, all right, all right.
How do wombats poop cubes? The obvious first guess would be square butthole. So David poked around, and I want to just show you this video.
You can't tell, but I'm sort of like silently clapping.
It's a CT scan of a wombat ass.
I loudly clap.
It's coming your way. We'll put it on Instagram and Twitter at ELT Show.
Yeah, okay, I see it.
Okay.
Ooh, okay. All right. That, I mean, that is unmistakable. That little white hole, I put my mouse right in the middle of it. That is a butthole. And it is not square.
Looks pretty circular to me.
They were back to square one. So they deduced that the cubing had to happen in the digestive tract. But how? To figure this out, David dissected some wombat guts. Australian colleagues sent David an intestine filled with poop from a recently deceased wombat.
Oh my gosh. How excited was David when he got this package of crap-infested intestine?
He said it was like Christmas morning.
Yeah, no doubt.
So we hung the intestines from the ceiling, kind of like Christmas ornaments. And when they stopped swinging, we saw that all the cubes were aligned. So the corners are all facing the same direction.
Okay. So you've got intestines hung from the ceiling with their poo still in them, and all the stars are aligning.
Not the stars or the seahorses. Cubes.
Right.
So this alignment was a clue.
The fact that they were aligned suggested to me that the intestines knew what they were doing. There's basically a plan for where one corner is going to be and where the flat face is.
Yes. Yep. The artist has a plan. I would have made the same assertion.
So David suspected the cubes were formed by the intestinal walls. And he did some analyzing and he found some parts of the intestine stretched more than others.
Mm-hmm.
Let's break this down and digest it. First, think about your own intestine, a lovely long tube. Now imagine slicing out a little cross-section of it so that you have a ring, kind of like a ring of calamari. Are you with me?
Yes, yes.
I don't know if they serve calamari at Outback?
I've got the calamari in my head. That's what you need to know.
Okay, so if you took that ring of human calamari and stretched it out, like to use it for a hair tie, you would see that that ring is uniformly stretchy. No part of the ring is stretchier than any other part of the ring. And that's how we thought intestines worked until David got his hands on these wombat guts.
We found when we stretched the intestine, certain parts stretched more than others.
Imagine a ring divided into four sections. The sections on the top and the bottom are stiffer. They're less stretchy than the ones on the sides. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's what a wombat's whole poop tube is like.
It's like soft, stiff, soft, stiff.
So David plugged this information into a mathematical model of the intestine, and he ran simulations of what happens as the poop moves through the intestine. So like a lover at a train station, the intestines squeeze the poop. If the intestines squeezed uniformly, you would end up with just a slimmer tube of poop, okay? But because wombat intestines have these stiff sections, the poop doesn't get squeezed, and voila, you get poop corners.
Amazing. So like if you're making sausages, if you were like squishing whatever, pork, into a wombat intestine, some of it would kind of would stretch a little. But then if I was like a little bit of pork sitting in that intestine, like I'd be like, I'm stuck on the stiff side. So I'd be flat. I couldn't stretch it out.
Yes, that is a simplified way to visualize what's actually a super complicated mathematical explanation.
That's great. And so the big question, of course, is why did the wombat evolve this mechanism?
Yeah, that's the number two question. It's up for debate, but here's the theory. So we know wombats mark their territory with their poop.
They'll actually go to the tallest place they can climb, which is usually a stump or a rock, and they'll actually poop on top of there. And so I think the sort of first wombat ground zero, when it pooped, a cylinder came out and it just rolled off the stone and just hit the ground. And they said, oh, this is a terrible marker. And part of the reason that is such an issue is because the poop is so dry to begin with. It doesn't have any adhesiveness. It's not sticky at all. So it just rolls.
The theory is that cubes are less likely to roll off that rock. Like a territory skid marked stays skid marked. So over thousands of years, wombats with square poop would be selected for.
Aha. That's super fun. I mean, I have no further questions.
All right, great. Well, before we let you go, though, just one quick thing. As you know, as an audio professional, we sometimes have to do a little edits here and there, replace words. Can you do me a favor and just read this list of words one at a time in case we need to replace anything?
Yeah.
And I'm gonna just pop them right into the chat so you can just read.
I know this is you're playing me for a fool, Flora. It's all gonna be like, g'day, Outback. The dingo ain't my baby.
I should let you keep going, but It's in a slightly different vein.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry, I was looking at Slack. Wait. Here we go.
If you could just pick it up right from Drop a Deuce and take it all the way down to Cock-a-doodle-doo-doo. If you could just do each one twice, like in slightly different intonations, that'd be perfect.
Shut up.
Every Little Thing is produced by Caitlin O'Keefe, Stephanie Werner, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Our consulting editors are Caitlin Kenny and Jorge Just. Scored by Billy Libby, Dara Hirsch, and Bobby Lord. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. ELT is a Spotify original podcast. Cock-a-doodle-doo-doo. Goodbye.